If you've ever had that feeling at work, you know, where the company's stated values just don't seem to match the day-to-day reality.
Or when you look at certain political movements and wonder how they can demand such total intellectual uniformity from their followers.
Exactly. If that sounds familiar, you've landed right where we're starting this deep dive.
The premise we're working with today, it's pretty simple, but its implications are, well, they're massive. It's that leadership determines culture.
Always. Whether it's a healthy workplace, a functioning democracy, or an ethical community.
The tone, the rules, the risk of harm, it all flows from the top.
So our mission today is to hand you a kind of diagnostic map. We've taken the source material and distilled it into a framework with five key leadership archetypes on a continuum.
And this tool is really for you, the learner. The idea is that you can use it to assess almost any group.
Your company, a political party, even a local civic group. And see how close it might be to exhibiting coercive or more destructive dynamics.
Before we jump in, we need a clean baseline. That phrase, cult-like dynamics, it's very highly charged.
It is.
So we're using a mainstream definition that's focused purely on observable behavior. We're talking about a group with excessive control, psychological coercion, and strict boundaries that isolate members.
And, crucially, strong pressure to conform. It's a diagnosis of behavior, not a judgment on belief.
Exactly.
And the key ingredient that makes all of this work, that makes it sustainable, is the idea of being insular. I think people often confuse that with just being isolated.
They do, and the sources make a really strong distinction. Insularity isn't just separation. It's the active maintenance of a closed system of ideas.
So it's about building walls.
Intellectual and informational walls. The group discourages outside perspectives, frames outsiders as a threat, or maybe just as inferior or misinformed.
And if you dissent from inside.
You're punished socially, emotionally, maybe even professionally.
Okay, so if we apply that filter right now, and we're being impartial here, just looking at the structure, you can see how parts of political parties can adopt these dynamics.
Absolutely. When you see blind loyalty, the demonization of outsiders with that rigid us versus them
And
framing,
that tight control of information.
you are watching the mechanisms of insularity at work. That pattern, regardless of the group's stated goals, it all begins and ends with the kind of power the leader wants to exert.
So that diagnosis of behavior is key, but where does it start? It has to start with the leader. The foundation of our spectrum moves beyond a simple good versus bad.
Right. Our core dichotomy is all about the nature of the relationship. On one side, we have the leader who is guiding, a person who helps guide another's way.
And that's a horizontal relationship, right? More collaborative.
Exactly. It's built on trust, shared purpose, it's relational.
And on the other side, where the risk goes up quite a bit, is the leader who is commanding. We're calling this the authority-based leader.
And this person's influence comes from a vertical structure. It's power over others based on formal
That
authority.
vertical structure is so important. It's the foundation for the whole five-part continuum, from most destructive to most constructive.
It is. So at the far destructive end, we place the demagogue.
Okay.
This is the leader who appeals strictly to prejudice, to fear. They make false claims, grand promises, all just to gain power. They don't guide, they incite.
Moving in from there.
We find the transactional leader, the authority-based one. This is the person who relies on compliance, formal authority. Do this, get that.
Rewards and consequences. It's
Yes.
the default for most hierarchies, isn't it? It's not automatically evil, but.
It's fragile, very fragile.
Then in the middle, we have the guiding leader we mentioned, the one who operates horizontally, offering support, sharing knowledge.
Their goal is development, not just compliance.
But guidance isn't always enough to create change. So next on the spectrum is the hero. This one is crucial.
It is. The hero acts as the internal moral compass. This is the person who protects dignity, who speaks up against harm, even when it comes at a huge personal or social risk.
So the hero is the person who calls out injustice in the moment, but they're not necessarily trying to tear down the entire system.
Precisely. Their courage is interpersonal, it's moral, it's essential for survival, but it's not enough for system-wide change. Which brings us to the highest end,
The transformational leader.
or inspirational leader. This person inspires an inclusive vision, they elevate others through empowerment, and they actually catalyze meaningful, lasting change in the system itself. They shift mindsets, not just punch numbers.
So there's our map. Demagogue, transactional, guiding, heroic, and transformational. And I think we need to spend a little time in that transactional space, because that's where most of us live, most workplaces.
It is.
You said it exists on a risk spectrum.
It does. A healthy transactional leader, say, a manager who uses their authority to get you resources and provide clear, fair expectations. They're actually pretty close to the guiding leader.
But that authority can be weaponized.
And when it is, they become the manipulative transactional leader.
So what does that weaponization look like? What's the mechanism?
It's the shift.
Right.
It's when authority stops being used for shared goals and starts being used for the leader's own self-interest and control. The sources say this leader uses incentives to coerce, to suppress evidence, or dissent.
Pushing them dangerously close to demagogic behavior.
Right. They create an environment where the ends always, always justify the means.
We saw a really devastating real-world example of this with Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family. I mean, that wasn't a political group. It was a company.
A company built on highly structured transactional principles.
So how did that become so cult-like?
Because the core driver was just unchecked greed. The leadership used massive financial incentives, huge commissions, bonuses to control employee behavior, to suppress all the evidence about the addiction risks of OxyContin.
They put financial gain over public health.
And use their authority to control the narrative, inside and out. The whole transactional structure became a coercion machine, driving system-wide harm for pure self-interest.
And while that's an extreme case, the fallout from this kind of leadership is... well, it's everywhere. There's 2025 data showing that 77% of employees say workplace stress is negatively affecting their health.
77%. That figure is staggering. We're talking about more than 3 out of 4 people.
Which means this isn't just a few bad apples. It's a systemic feature of inadequate, authority-based leadership, a high risk of dehumanization.
High stress is the body's response, physically and psychologically, to a loss of control and dignity.
So how does this destructive transactional style, the one that relies on vertical power, create these toxic, psychologically violent environments?
For that, we can turn to Philip Zimbardo's work on the Lucifer effect. His research, especially the Stanford Prison Experiment, shows how cruelty thrives when the system itself enables an abuse of that vertical authority.
What were the mechanisms he identified?
Things like constant gaslighting, the excessive egotism of the people in power, and something he called intellectualization.
Intellectualization. You mean using logic to justify being cruel.
Precisely. It's using corporate jargon, academic metrics, or scientific detachment to justify ethical drift. We have to cut this resource, or the data requires this sacrifice.
Zimbardo's main point was that removing personal identity enables cruelty, calling prisoners by a number.
You stop seeing people.
You stop seeing a person with a family and a life, and you start seeing an object, a variable to be managed.
And destructive transactional leaders often use this dehumanizing language, sometimes without even realizing it. They call human beings resources, headcount, or liabilities.
And once a person becomes a liability,
their suffering can be justified for the greater good of the organization. The system turns people into disposable units.
So if the problem is this dehumanizing, metrics-driven worldview, then the solution, the shift to constructive leadership, has to move away from outcomes and self-interest.
It has to move toward intrinsic values. Humility, compassion, generosity. And there's a core trait and insight that separates the heroic and transformational leaders from the purely transactional ones.
And what's that?
It's what the Germans call Menschenkenntnis.
Menschenkenntnis. Okay, what is that exactly?
It literally means knowledge of human nature. It's the ability to truly sense character, to have deep human insight, and to instinctively prioritize a person's dignity over, say, a quarterly metric.
It's the ability to see the world beyond the spreadsheet.
It is. Leaders with Menschenkenntnis are highly self-reflective. They get that real motivation is intrinsic. It's not something you can just buy with a bonus or generate with fear. They know people thrive when they are respected.
And that insight must change everything about how they communicate.
It does. Which brings us to the real antidote to that vertical domination. Edgar Schein's communication continuum gives us a blueprint.
Schein contrasts domination, which is telling, ordering, imposing your agenda.
The hallmark of the demagogue and the destructive transactional leader.
Right. He contrasts that with humble inquiry.
Which is the relational end of the spectrum.
Can you describe humble inquiry for us? It sounds like it's more than just being curious.
It's much deeper. It's a genuine curiosity paired with active listening. And, this is the most important part, the suspension of judgment. The leader has to be vulnerable enough to admit they don't have all the answers.
They're asking questions to truly understand, not to test someone or control the conversation.
Exactly. And that act of humble inquiry is what flattens the power structure.
How so?
When a leader genuinely listens, they create psychological safety. They confer dignity on the person they're listening to. It directly fights dehumanization because the leader is forced to confront the person's identity, their agency.
Okay, so if we know what fuels this destructive leadership insularity, domination, we need some accessible antidotes for demagoguery. What are the paths to resilience?
The first is education, but not just any education. The real antidote is teaching people how to think. Critical thinking, self-reflection, moral reasoning, not what to think, which is just ideology or dogma.
So critical thinking is the primary inoculation against fear-based rhetoric.
It is. The second antidote is exposure.
Exposure.
Gordon Allport's research is really powerful here. He found that meaningful contact with different groups through travel, reading, genuine conversation, it actively reduces prejudice because it shatters that insularity.
You can't sustain a rigid ease versus them narrative when you've genuinely experienced the them.
It becomes impossible.
And what about the personal antidote? For you, listening and navigating your own life, what are the red flags to watch out for?
Recognize the tells. Look for the fragile ego in a leader, the constant gaslighting to make you doubt your own reality, the lack of respect for your personal time.
A sense of entitlement that demands your total energy.
Exactly. You have to prioritize your self-care and your boundaries over some misplaced loyalty to a toxic leader or a fragile system. Loyalty shouldn't require self-sacrifice.
And this idea of valuing personal empowerment over obedience, it makes me think of the distinction people often make now, describing themselves as spiritual but not religious.
That narrative fits our framework perfectly. Organized religion, when it's focused on rigid rules, fixed dogma, strict obedience, it risks exhibiting destructive transactional leadership.
Because it's based on external motivation, fear of damnation, promise of reward.
Right. It's compliance driven by reward and punishment. Spirituality, on the other hand, usually aligns much more with guiding and heroic leadership. It focuses on intrinsic values, personal growth, ethical integrity.
It's a shift from a system of compliance to one based on compassion.
And self-actualization. It promotes dignity and agency.
This has been a really comprehensive map of power from politics to the office. Before we wrap up, let's just synthesize the framework we've built.
We've laid out a continuum. At one end, you have the demagogue and the destructive transactional leader. They're driven by ego, by self-interest, by domination.
Their only goal is obedience, and the result is a massive risk of dehumanization.
Hierarchies are rigid. Communication is top-down.
And at the other end, you have the heroic and transformational leader. They're driven by promoting dignity, by intrinsic motivation, and by that key idea, menschenkenntnis.
Human insight. For them, cooperation replaces obedience. Hierarchies flatten, creating an environment where people can not only perform, but genuinely thrive.
So the success of a leader isn't measured by obedience.
No, it's measured by the degree to which they shift their focus from ego toward dignity and human insight. The ability to practice humble inquiry is really the litmus test.
This framework is a powerful diagnostic tool. But let's end with a provocative thought, one that challenges the very systems that have let transactional leadership become our default mode.
Well, if you look at early psychology back in the 1930s, it included the concept of the psyche, which was mind, spirit, meaning the whole person.
But as science sought more measurable rigor, it started to rely almost exclusively on quantification.
Exactly. We started reducing the rich human experience, ethical dilemmas, the search for meaning, moral values, to just variables, metrics, data points that could be standardized.
And that heavy reliance on quantification in both social sciences and management theory created a kind of vacuum.
A deep vacuum in our shared language. We stripped away the language of human meaning and inherent worth. And that left a space that transactional systems, which only speak the language of metrics.
And demagogic narratives, which offer simple emotional answers.
Were more than eager to exploit.
So the challenge for you, the learner, is to recognize that vacuum. How can you actively integrate that human-centered insight, the ethics, the meaning, the intrinsic values, back into your own professional and civic lives?
How can you champion menschenkenntnis and the dignity it implies to build real resilience against dehumanization in your own circles? The tools are here. The choice to observe, diagnose, and lead with dignity is now yours.
That is the deep dive. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.